putting a small sheet of paper, notepad paper, on the floor in front of 10 people, telling them that's the Event Horizon. What are you going to do about it?
Welcome back to episode 27. We were lucky enough to sit and chat with Johan from Gothenburg Mega Games to talk about Event Horizon, which is one of the games that he has designed. All things going well, Event Horizon will actually be available for you to purchase and play when this episode goes live. Aside from the game itself, we had a really good discussion about design philosophy around Mega Games. We heard a lot about Johan's process and some of the key components that make that process sing, from trusting control to trusting the mechanics to also, and probably most importantly, making people awesome, which is one of my favorites. And there's also quite a bit of cosmic horror in there. Hopefully you enjoy. All right, and Johan, maybe you could start us off this evening or this morning, as it is for you. If you wanted to just give us a bit of an introduction to yourself, for those who don't already know you, and how you sort of became a mega gamer, and more importantly, a mega game designer.
That's more than one question, but I'll give it a go.
One.
My name is Johan. I'm a mega game aficionado, which means I do more mega gaming than is possibly sane, I think. I started in 2017. a friend of mine said, because I was just getting back into board gaming after like a long hiatus. I was playing a lot of stuff in my teens and lots of board games, but most of all like role-playing games, trying to get back into that. A friend of mine said, "It's a huge convention full of nerds, you should go to that." And I wasn't feeling the whole nerd thing at that point in my life, so I was a bit skeptical. And he said, no, there's this thing, it should be right up your alley. It's called a mega game, and you don't have to prep. You don't just turn up to the thing and do the thing for a couple of hours, and that's the end of it. And he showed me the shut up and sit down video, Watch the Skies. And I thought, well, seems interesting. I went to the thing, to the convention. I only went to the convention to play the mega game. And then I went home and started Googling when's the next game. Turns out there were zero games running in Sweden at that time, and I played at the convention in Sweden. So I found another run of Watch the Skies in Brighton like a month after, maybe. So knowing nobody in the mega game scene in the UK, I just flew over to Brighton to play Watch the Skies with Simon Appleton's excellent group there. They run things sporadically, but if you ever get a chance maybe not you guys in Australia, but anyone who gets a chance to play with Simon's group, they're a really fun bunch, and I think a lot of like theatre people and people like that. So they made it like an excellent Watch This Guys event. And after that, it was like 3 or 4 weeks until I played, I think it was Urban Nightmare in London, and then it just spiraled from that. I played so many games before the pandemic. Started up the Gothenburg Mega Games group in Gothenburg, where I'm based pretty much 50% of my time at least. And then from that point on, just took us into the pandemic, then started doing online games during the pandemic. And I think we're, for Gothenburg Mega Games, we passed 25 games run last year, about this time last year. Games played, let's not mention that number.
I've got so many questions, and that was going to be one of them. With the 25 run in Gothenburg, though, when did that, does that count online games?
It probably does, yeah.
Okay, all right. And that's since what you said
2018 we started. We ran our first Watch the Skies in like January, February 2018.
Right, okay. I'm fascinated because usually nearly everyone who comes on says that, you know, when we ask this question, it's they watch the Shut Up, Sit Down video, and then there's a few that haven't come into it via that avenue. You're like unique though, because you came into it, but several years later, you didn't jump on the original hype, the hype bandwagon.
No, my friend Nicholas, who I design games with, who was a huge help on Event Horizon and on other projects that I'm working on, he just basically insisted that I go to it. I would not have been in this hobby if it hadn't been for him.
Mm. Well, everyone, I think, listening can thank him for his service. Event Horizon, as you mentioned, is the game we're talking about today. Was this the first mega game that you've designed?
No. From a sort of design perspective, we bought What's the Skies when we were going to run our first game, and my group are a bunch of people who have sort of different angles on gaming. So we have a professor of game design from the University of Gothenburg. We have Josephine, who's like a very respected person in LARPing and does a lot of research, academic research on LARPing. Nicholas, who's a computer game designer. Marcus, who is like a board game reviewer. So we all sat down with Watch the Skies and tried to understand what it was. We all thought it was, by looking at the rules and the design of that, thought it was absolute garbage. We decided to redesign it, and we made it a lot worse and decided to run it sort of out the box instead to just understand what it was. And I think my own experience, not coming from that world, but I do a lot of workshops and different process designs for work. So I deal a lot with people and the way people act in groups and stuff like that. So I think I had probably the most sort of impact on the way that we then ran games. Jump a couple of years forward, I was approached by, maybe 1 year forward, and I was approached by Luca, who works at Paradox, the computer game company, and they had run what he said was a mega game version of Europa Universalis 30 Years War for their Paradox Con in, I think they ran it in Germany or somewhere. And we started chatting about that, and we met up, and he said, yeah, this game, and he described it, and I thought, that seems amazing, let's run that, because since we didn't design games, we were sort of reliant on other games being sort of ready to run. And at this point in 2018, I think those Watch the Skies, we managed to persuade Alex Beck to package up Crisis in Elysium and give that to us. I think Den of Wolves was just coming out at that time. So there weren't that many games. So have been given the chance of running Europa Universalis, a game that Paradox designed, a mega game. In fact, the Paradox design seemed like an absolute dream come true, and just Luca dropping that in our lap. And we said, great. And in my usual enthusiasm to get things going, I set the date, started selling tickets. We got the game design from Luca, and it was two A4 pages of text. That was it. No components, no nothing, just an outline of something you could do for fun at a convention. And we started panicking, absolutely panicking. This was like two, three months before we were supposed to run. And in an absolute just panic, I hooked up with Odd Helge of Oslo Mega Games. And we started just frantically trying to make something out of this thing. We managed to do it, and it ran and was really well received. And I'll quote Odd Helge, despite of the mechanics. that was my first mega game design. A very sort of rushed version of Europa Universalis, just because we started selling tickets.
Jeez,
it's a trial by fire.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Wow. Okay. So from there, you obviously got to make a few more deliberate choices, I suppose, in your design career. Were there any others that popped up before Event Horizon came along?
No. Then after that, we had a sort of cooling off period, trying to sort of figure out what do we want to do with this, and what am I interested in sort of design wise, and what do I want to run? What would be interesting as sort of a budding game designer? What's interesting about mega games? And that takes us back to that sort of my initial romance with mega games, not being sort of from a game design perspective, but rather sort of what happens when people start interacting. Mm. And I was playing some game in London, and by that time I'd been in the hobby for about 2 years, I think, and made lots of friends in the UK, and we were hanging out at Chris Brown's house doing something, a day of gaming, something else. And I said, if people wouldn't mind staying on for an hour afterwards and just trying out this idea that I have for a mega game based loosely on the greatest movie ever made, which is Event Horizon, a 90s horror movie. If you haven't seen it, you must see it rather that than you play the game. But my idea was basically putting a small sheet of paper, notepad paper, on the floor in front of 10 people, telling them that's the Event Horizon, what are you going to do about it, and then observing them plan their approach to the Event Horizon for about 30 minutes, and then watching them try to breach the Event Horizon from the outside for another 20, and then some, you know, ideas discussion off the back of that. And this sort of emergent design then became something else and something bigger. But the idea for the Event Horizon has always been me putting something very sort of mysterious in front of the players and then letting them have the tools to interact with it. But there's nothing more to it than that. It's all in the player's head and the way they interact with it. There's no story, there's nothing.
That's a really fascinating way to play test, like before you have the mechanics or anything like that, to just dive into the story and the way people interact with each other and build it out of that. That's amazing.
Yeah, I was going to say that's a good place for all mega games to start, where you just put something on the floor and say, hey, that's something, and then you just observe.
Yeah.
I like your strategy.
But I think designing with Nicholas, for instance, he comes from a completely different angle. He starts off with what sort of mechanics are going to be fun and that sort of thing. And I think I start off with the question, is this interesting in any way? And then try that. And if it's interesting to the players enough for them to sort of invest an hour into investigating something or whatever, and interacting with each other, then that's something, and then build off the back of that.
So I think Event Horizon, it's a really pretty well established mega game at this stage. You've got quite a few. There's a design interview on the Mega Game Assembly website, and a podcast episode, and a couple of articles with after action reports and things like that from back in 2019. But yeah, for those who haven't heard of it before, what's the elevator pitch? Or for people who haven't seen the movie, which is an incredible movie, you absolutely should see it. But for people who haven't heard of the game or heard of the movie, what's it about? What's an overview of it?
Well, story-wise, a deep space exploration ship goes missing. There's a cover-up, but as the ship then comes back 7 years later, the sort of cover is blown, and a couple of teams of specialists are sent there to investigate and figure out where it's been, why was it gone, and why is it back? And the game centers around a lot of exploration themes and interacting with the unknown and just the this is now veering off the elevator pitch, but it is really about exploration, and you don't really need to know much about gaming or just need to be curious about interacting with the unknown.
Very much like a cosmic horror type of experience, right?
Oh yeah, absolutely.
And so one thing that I wanted to ask about the theme was sort of, I mean, you've kind of spoken about this, and it's pretty clear from the way that you pitched this originally about sort of observing people, about how they respond to a prompt. But what made you pick this specific one when you were back in the day deciding Event Horizon is the game I want to create? What was it about this that film's inspiration that really sold you?
I think just the fact that I keep coming back to that movie. I am not a person who's into nostalgia. I've been in the creative industry for like 30 years in music and doing other things, and some people, and I'm not saying I'm not knocking it in any way, but some people decide in like their 20s what music they're going to listen to for the rest of their lives and what movies they like, and they come back to that with a sort of sense of identity and nostalgia. And I've never really had that, but The Event Horizon, which was released in like end of 90s somewhere, I keep coming back to that. I rewatch it pretty much every year. Before I sort of, not an obsession with it, not I don't, there's apparently a TV show in the making by Amazon. I'm not very keen about that. There's something about that movie that makes me come back to it, and I wanted to sort of understand if that's what that is. I want to understand what that is, and I have this fascination of this type of horror, very Lovecraftian sort of what's that in the corner of your eye sort of type of horror, not in your face slasher, that kind of thing, even though that could be entertaining. But I kept coming back to this movie, and I maybe subconsciously wanted to do something so I could let go of this movie, some sort of catharsis of maybe if other people figure out what this is, then I can let it go. That's been the opposite, actually. Yeah. But I think it's just been there. I want to explore it more.
Yep. And it seems like it's the case for other people as well, because it's been very well received and very successful, I suppose. People are engaged with it, even you know, whether it's the film or it's your take on it, turning it into this to this forum. Before we dive into like the specifics of the game, the one thing that really jumped out at me that I put in our notes before the show was looking at the rulebook, which you were kind enough to share with us. And really early on, it makes this reference. Well, it's got a whole chapter called "Make People Awesome." Did you want to? I think you've kind of touched on this already, but did you just want to walk us through that ideology and why that's front and center in this book?
Yeah, it's. I think it's there are a couple of aspects to that. First of all, is any mega game needs some rules for how the reality in which the mega game takes place, how that works. But watch this, guys. It's the real world. Everything is as you expect. And your sort of deep or limited understanding of global politics will guide you through this game. Some other games have richer sort of world building that goes into it. You read a document about the world, like Crisis in Elysium or other sort of space-themed games, where you sort of get an idea of what is this about, what rules guide this this place. For historical mega games, you might, worst case scenario, get like an 80-page document of rich historical text trying to explain what rules guide this sort of thing. So what I wanted to do is combine that and not having people read too much. But as long as other people have a grasp on what they are doing, and every player has a name tag with their sort of role on it, combine that with a design idea that I think is absolutely stunning from Den of Wolves, which is basically every resolution goes through the players first and control second. So if you want to do something special, you have to do it through a player rather than through control. So the make people awesome idea, and I've stolen it off of LARPs basically. If your name tag says doctor, then people will play in a way where they assume you know everything about medicine, which means that going into this game, if you see a player with a doctor name tag, you can come up to them and say, my leg's missing, and they will immediately start acting like they know what they're doing. And you will respect their opinion and don't go, well, I don't think that I'd need... Well, you can ask for a second opinion if you can find a second doctor, but just playing into this thing where people get a chance to be an awesome doctor. And it's especially important for this game because it's a game in three acts, and I think we'll come back to that. But the rescue mission to the Event Horizon quickly goes to shit if there's no organization. Mm. And there's a team dedicated to organizing the mission, and it's the UN team. And if people don't act like they are absolutely decorated war heroes who know what they're doing, then the whole system falls apart. So I need that this is a hero. You respect this person. You've seen them in the papers, and you will play as if they are this amazing person. And everyone has a chance to be this amazing person. And if there's one sentence that is really core to the way that I run games, is to brief people by saying, if you make the game fun for two other people, then we've all won today, because then that sort of multiplies throughout the game. But that's the center of make people awesome.
I'm taking many, many notes. Thank you. it's such a good like foundational design philosophy, and I'm the same as your friend you mentioned earlier, where sometimes I get too ripped up with the design of the mechanics and how they can be abstracted to represent different things, and you know, lose track sometimes, lose sight of the player roles and their agency. So that's really good.
Yeah, but I think on that note, I think it's equally the two parts that need to be there. You need three maybe. three, trying to get. I'll do the third one first, and it's trusting control, trusting the people who run the game. I think that's in my designs. I want to make that redundant. I don't really think you maybe need that much GMing or controlling of a game if it's well designed. But the other two things are, you need to trust the mechanics. So the rules apply in the same way to all people. And I understand how they operate, and I can understand my input into it, and I can understand the output that comes out. But I also need to be able to trust the other players in the way that they act. And if you have those two things, and trust can be, I can trust this player to put a knife in my back. I have a good friend called Paul who always does that at every game. So I know that's what's going to happen. I can trust him to do that. But and he's always put in roles, but that is the expected outcome. But I think those two things, if you can trust the mechanics and trust other people to make your experience enjoyable, then you don't really need control.
Let's talk about those acts of the game, I guess, and get kind of into the details of how it all plays out in practice, I think. So I believe it kind of starts out like Act 1 is approaching the Event Horizon for a couple of turns. Then you have an act of exploring the Event Horizon, And finally, an act where the ship returns home, potentially in a terrified retreat. how does that play out? I'm very interested about this first phase of, like, approaching the event horizon. How does that, like, play out on the day, and how do people... Yeah, what are people kind of up to in that part of the game?
It is... But it has two purposes that are basically the same purpose, but split into two parts. It's expectation setting, because what I noticed that first time when I put that sheet of notepad paper in the center of the room was everyone was pushing all the other people aside, trying to get to the event horizon and start just messing around with it. And that, in a sort of real world-ish situation, would be a very bad way of approaching a rescue mission. So it's forcing players to plan and set expectations for what they're going to be doing during the day. And it has several purposes of players getting to know each other, players getting to talk about the setting. There's a shared expectations within the team. Each team has their own objectives. How are they going to do that? But also interacting with and establishing the UN command of the fleet, et cetera, et cetera. So I think about 2/3 of the players do that. The rest of the players start in stasis. So there's one narrative being, or one expectation being established with 2/3 of the players. And that is, this is going to be a controlled mission. We are in control. We are planning. We are sharing resources. And this is going to be a breeze. And then you establish that for 60 minutes. During those 60 minutes, about 45 of those, the other third of the players are in stasis, having a nightmare that they are on the event horizon, which means we move those players into the event horizon area of the game, usually a separate room, but we've done it in the same room. But there needs to be like a physical divide between the two areas of the game. And they go through a horrifying nightmare of being on the event horizon, being attacked by monsters, and establishing a very different expectation of what you can expect from going onto the ship. Then the last 15 minutes, they're all together again, the full game, 100% of the players, where for 45 minutes, the 2/3 have planned for a very controlled mission. The last 15 minutes, players come back and go, I don't ever want to set foot on that ship. It's on fire. The people, bodies are everywhere. There's just chaos. Let's turn around and not do this. So that's the first phase. And that needs to be sort of as quick and stressful and limited in the amount of information that players can get back. But 1/3 of the players will have sort of an idea of the layout of the event horizon, which the 2/3 don't. And then time for exploring it, figuring out, if I flip this switch, what happens? A couple of things that you want to do, like rescue survivors if you can find them. Getting to the bridge, getting to the engine, switching things on, and there are a bunch of sort of narrative threads that players can sort of pick up on. All narrative threads are tied to player action, so there's really nothing there to find unless you start messing around with things and people drawing conclusions from that. And the event horizon is explored in groups of maybe 4 or 5 players in each group, and they can see from across the room that another group of players they're doing something, and something else happens, and they connect that something happening to the other group of players doing something shady. There's a lot of distrust, and then the game just riffs off of that, basically. Players not trusting each other, which is a very mega game thing. Usually around the sort of 4.5 hour mark, things have escalated to the point where it's either you are a part of the ship and you're trying to either take it into deep space or return it to Earth or run it into the sun or extinguish the sun. There's been so many. Every game has had its own ending. Just other players scrambling to get to their ships to maybe return to Earth to warn them before everything goes to shit. But it's the last phase is usually maybe 45 minutes of very stressful trying to stay alive sort of thing. So those are the three phases.
Awesome. Yeah, I really love building this three-act structure into it, because I feel like in a horror game or a horror movie, foreshadowing and build-up is such a critical part of it. You can't get straight to the monster or it doesn't have any impact. So I really love, the fact that approaching the event horizon, not even going onto the ship, but like getting there or having a nightmare about it is like a key part of the game. That's awesome. I had a bit of a listen to the Mega Game Assembly podcast about it, and one of the pieces of feedback I heard about the game is people saying that they really loved doing that nightmare segment, and they kind of wish that everyone got to do that nightmare segment of doing a bit on the event horizon. I'm curious about that decision. Did you feel like you really wanted to have like a divide between people who are like, the mission's under control, we've got it handled, and the people who've had the nightmare in stasis? Or what was the decision there?
Yeah, the shared experience should be based off of different contrasting experiences. I think that's the way to go. And also it puts a break on the players who really just want to go for it. And during the stasis scenario, it is very high tempo, lots of explosions, fires, things happening. And when you first enter the event horizon, there's a contrast of that can absolutely happen, but it's not the first thing that's gonna bite you in the ass, basically. I think the sort of general thing I'm going for players to take away after the game is that the evil on board the Event Horizon was the evil that we brought along with us. Rather than, because it's just an empty ship. If people just go, thanks, no thanks, we'll just not touch this thing, then it's a very quick game of an hour of getting there and just deciding to go home. There's nothing inherently, it's not alive, there's nothing there, but the play is really, I had this sort of, and it goes back to this sort of experimental thing of what makes people act crazy during like last turn madness and things like that happens in mega games. Some players just go off the rails, and is there a way to put that into mechanics so not all players go off the rails, but enough players go off the rails without us having to do anything, to have that to be, because for the Swedish game, we have a very sort of LARPy scene here, so a lot of people who want to go into the role playing and they have an idea of what they want to do, and some people are there for the mechanical bits and just find the balance of letting people go off in their own directions without being sort of constrained by the narrative or constrained by the mechanics or constrained by sort of anything else, but not in a way that becomes the game. So if you're not going insane and not doing crazy things, then you won't have a game. I want that sort of tug of war between the sort of sensibilities of this mission being very serious and a life and death situation and still allowing for some people. There's nothing in the briefings that will let any specific players know or brief them to go off the rails in any way. There's nothing like that. It's purely based off of how you act on the event horizon. And mechanically, that means that if you start acting in a specific way, you will accumulate, we have dice as a sort of currency in the game that unlocks certain actions. And if you start going in one route, you will accumulate black dice. Then you can do more crazy shit, And that accumulates even more black dice. And there's no limit to how many black dice can be in play, etc. But it's that thing where you allow people to take their role or actions in whatever direction they feel on the day.
That's awesome.
And I know that sounds, I know that might come across as very, very chaotic and off-putting to some organizer that want to have a nice and controlled day of resolving mechanics and not trusting players to do to make the game a good game. But I think sort of having a mechanical framework for that, trusting that framework, trusting players to not break those assumptions about the world, it just really works.
Mm-hmm. So do you have many pre-written or pre-thought up plot points that people are discovering, or little narrative details?
Zero.
Or is it really a focus on emergent storytelling and like the things that players come up with as they come into contact with stuff?
Yeah, it's if players discover a combination of different things. Let's say they go into a room, they find they search through a locker and they find explosives, and that's the life support room. And they go to Control and say, "Why are these things here?" And Control will just say, "Well, what would make sense to you?" And the group of four players will go, "Oh, it must be those pesky Russians, or it must be there's that." And there's sort of, in the briefings, I'm hinting at sort of different possible assumptions that you can have about this mission. So some people are wary of other teams. Some people are looking for specific things. But those things are just in the players' heads. There's nothing there to. Some players have been briefed to turn on the servers, and that's it. There's no. Then what happens when you turn on the servers? That's up to the players to describe and feedback into the game, and that becomes the narrative and the truth of what the narrative is. What is true? What is objectively true in this game? Nothing. It's all subjective assumptions about how this world works, based on group thinking decision making under stress.
I love that. It reminds me a lot of kind of Silent Hill, like the only hell is the hell you've brought in with you, or that it's just a reflection of your own things being reflected back at you. That's awesome. Well, I think let's dive into some of the mechanics of how this exploration of the event horizon works. So, yeah, basically, from my understanding, you have a little minifigure that you use to move across a map of the event horizon, and then each character will have a pool of dice that they use to perform actions and things like that.
Yeah, and these colored dice are, I think there are like five different colors, depending on, if you're an engineer, you will have yellow dice. And that's also a way of looking across the table when you need an engineer and immediately see there's somebody who can act in this situation. There's a person there with lots of yellow dice. And there's blue for science, red for physical actions, there's white for commandy, leadership, techie type of things, and there's black for just wild dice, basically. The mini is really important because in some mega games you can run around the room and do whatever you like and talk to whoever you like. In this game you're tied to wherever your mini is, but your mini is free to move anywhere, as long as you can sort of trace a path, or when you're on the event horizon, take the needed amounts of steps. It's not there to restrict players, but put brakes on the game and have the flow of information not being too perfect or too quick. But you're free to move around with your mini to basically anywhere in the game, which makes for really interesting sort of. You can always see if someone's up to something, you can see beforehand where they're heading in that particular direction, or I can see them moving towards the bridge. They shouldn't be doing that. What are you doing? You can shout at them across the table, but in order to restrict them, you need to put your mini on the same square as their mini.
Nice. And then in order to complete actions, you basically put these dice together, right? It's like if you wanted to open up a locker, you would have a card with a requirement of blue 2 or yellow 3, and players would have to put those dice down to complete that thing, right?
Yeah, and the idea there is simply to have enough things to do in a room that one single player can't do it on their own. So and combinations of dice where you need to work together, but just combine your different dice to complete certain actions.
Yeah, awesome. So it forces working together. So how does, if you do see someone who's heading towards the bridge and you want to rush in and stop them, how does that work, the player versus player kind of side of it?
Yeah, we going back to the to playtesting this, we have this core group of insane people in London who have played a million mega games and know each other really well and want to make life as hard for the other players as possible during like a play test. So we had this action that is still in the game, which is called Subdue, which means that you can during a turn on board the Event Horizon, you get to move, take an action, move, take an action, move, take an action. So three iterations of that, and then it restarts, resets. We had that where a group of people, three people, decided that if we each use Subdue once during this three action iteration, we can keep this player pinned. So they can't go to the bridge. We just need to be three people to one person to subdue during the first action, second person to subdue during the second action, etc. So they just kept, again, this is Paul, who I love tormenting in both game design and real life mega games. So he was just locked in this thing where he couldn't get out, he couldn't move, he was completely stripped of agency. Which is never a good game design or never fun. So for Paul, I designed something called the Emergency Cable, which is a get out of jail free card, and you just shout Emergency Cable and you're pulled to where your ship is docked on the Event Horizon. Nobody can subdue you. You're being propelled at breakneck speed back towards your ship. So, but it is possible for, and that's also something which is really again putting brakes on the game. If you have three people entering the Event Horizon, one will quickly make it to the bridge, second will quickly secure life support, and the third will quickly turn on the engine. That's over in maybe 15 minutes. With with six players, that takes twice the amount of time, three times the pace, etc., etc. So the amount of players actually slow it down by, because if you add another, then you can stop the player going to the bridge. And then that player heading for the bridge needs to have friends to make sure he or she gets to the bridge. And that thing of never letting players act on their own. There are a couple of other things there that I can't talk about because that's a control right. thing. Control is there to make life really hard for people who try to go off on their own. It takes them back to the sort of stasis scenario. But just having people act in teams just seems to have people make really suboptimal decisions. And having to discuss everything before you act, not enforced in like this is discussion time and now you can act, but it just people usually talk to each other and usually argue, and that takes a bit of time. So we've always tried to get that sort of tug of war in this game, where you need to convince your teammates or other people on other teams to act in your interest if you want to get something done.
And with the some of the materials that you provided us before the game, before this conversation, I mean, to get a grasp of the game, I had a look at some of the briefings that seemed to go with the teams. Obviously, without, like you've mentioned a little bit about the player motivations and the guides, without going into, you know, real nitty-gritty and, I guess, spoiler territory, what kind of information do the different teams in this game get briefed on?
They get briefed on, I think, now you have to correct me because I don't have it in front of me, but I think they're being briefed on who they are, why they are there, a couple of objectives that they want to get done. And I think some dirt on other teams, I think, or at least sowing doubt about other teams.
And so when it comes to that subjective narrative building with players, who some players are given sort of inspiration before the game, you were saying that, you know, they need to get to turn the server on or something like that. Was that information briefed to them before the game as well, or is that stuff that Control seeds during the first phases of the game?
No, you get the way we've decided is it works best for this game is you have the team briefing sent out with all the briefing material like 2 weeks before the game. Individual briefings are handed out on the day, just because some people read it, some people don't, some people prep, some people don't. And I really want people to be prepping for their team stuff. And the individual briefings are very, very short, but they have something that ties them into, I can't remember how many narrative sort of threads there are for people to pull on, but I think something like 8 or 10 narrative threads that they can pull on. There's nothing but another player at the end of it. If you pull on that thread, another player is going to come to you. There's nothing attached to the actual game, but it's attached to another player. So if you pull on the turn on the servers thread, you're going to end up with another player who's also going to be very excited by turning on the servers. If you pull on some other thread, then you're going to find there's information about where the ship has been that some players are really interested in. And if they pull on that thread, they're going to end up with a buddy who's also interested in that sort of thing. And then they can explore on. So it's narrative threads just to encourage teamwork outside of teams.
Right. Yep. I'm keen to get into sort of how this game has run and how players have received it. But just quickly on, I guess, the production of the game and the design and the production of all the materials, we're going through the rulebook, and it's propped up with a lot of, it's really comprehensive rulebook. It's got a huge amount of sort of FAQ sections that jump out and answer questions that obviously come to mind when you're reading a certain rule. And there's a whole bunch of photos in there of the game being played, of the components being used, that kind of thing. How much of that polish has come from, like, the games? Like, how far has the game materials come, I suppose, since the very first run?
I think in terms of the game hasn't changed that much, but the material, especially like briefing materials and rule book, has changed quite a lot. But more in sort of trimming the fat sort of thing, and also trying to make it as concise and with examples. And we provide a mechanical rules video, because it is super important that all players understand how movement and doing actions work, and you learn that in 15 minutes and with that you can play the game without having read the manual, really. But it's just a lot of polish has gone into like the rule book over the iterations. I think we're at version 2.2 or something. And that went through like version 1 and version 1.something and a couple of iterations. But I think there's maybe iteration 7 or 8 of the rule book.
Right.
I try to update it off of people's questions during the game or setting expectations of different things.
So how many times has the game been run now in total?
I think it has run 7 times. I'm trying to do the math in my head, but I think we've run it twice in London, maybe 6 times. Yeah, something like that.
Yeah, that's awesome. What would you say is the biggest change that has happened over those versions, or the biggest alteration from the original to now?
Skipping the game timer has been the absolutely biggest one. This game runs without a timer now, and I'm really happy about that change. We've Wow. also tweaked the fleet game quite a bit, because that was my intention was to have the sort of fleet life be this sort of quiet contrast to the chaos on board the Event Horizon. Turns out that was not very fun for people to play the sort of quiet bit. So now that is equally hectic too. But it's the way that the game is intended to work is that on the fleet you're not supposed to know what's going on the Event Horizon unless somebody makes contact and explains that to you. So the sort of flow of information is really important, and planning for that is part of this first act. Just planning for how we're going to get information back. And the second run we did in Reading like a year ago, we had very experienced mega gamers, and very experienced mega gamers usually fail in this sort of making sure the flow of information. That's the one thing we always seem to forget, that the flow of information is crucial. And they failed to set that up. They planned for it, but once people got on the Event Horizon, they got sidetracked and didn't report back for an hour. And then things started happening on the fleet, and there was this super frustrated group of people trying to lead the rescue operation with zero understanding of what was actually happening, and just feeding that frustration back into somebody needs to go on board and figure out what's going on there, and then drawing the shortest stick of who shortest straw on who has to go on there and try and figure it out with a lot of people being on the fleet who went through this sort of stasis thing, going, I'm never setting foot on that ship again. So it's that a sort of but I think as control, that's the most important thing. When we run Event Horizons, to sort of not go to the Event Horizon room and say, look, guys, you need to really start reporting back because they're really getting frustrated in the other room, but rather use that frustration to fuel even worse decision making.
So removing the game timer, has that worked? Do you still have team time where people No, okay.
We have the Event Horizon at the start of the first iteration of the game. We had a game timer for the fleet, and we had thought a lot about how do you make a really sort of high paced game on board the Event Horizon where you're scrabbling to get things done. How do you make that with a timer? When some people take ages and go into analysis paralysis over which locker to open, and having to stand around and wait for people to do things, how do we balance that? So we decided in the first iteration that the game timer in on the Event Horizon would be the time it took players to do their actions. And then the second iteration, we decided that, well, each little group will have their own sort of action timer. So whenever they have done their three actions, then they take a bit of time to discuss what they want to do next, like 2 minutes, and then get back into doing movement and action again. So some teams, if they're efficient, they can move faster than other teams just off the back that their command structure is working, which is a reflection of how things would work in real life, I think. But then there would be a game timer still running in the fleet room, and that is to sort of the illusion of control, the illusion of a lot of the stuff I'm doing is sort of expectation management and smoke and mirrors type stuff. But that made that game feel slower than it needed to be. So we then put into place certain time slots where you can enter the Event Horizon for different reasons. And events happen on a timer, but the timer is not known to players. But it works on a sort of 20-minute thing where every 20 minutes the conditions outside the ships gets updated, sort of weather conditions and things that are happening. And players will be alerted to that. They get a chance to react to it and plan for it. They'll know beforehand with sort of diagnostic tools and such what they're expecting. Is there an electrical storm coming? Do we need to do something about that? They'll know that beforehand so they can plan. So it's that maintaining that illusion of control outside the Event Horizon without players being constricted by a timer.
Awesome. It sounds very intense. Do you find people miss the downtime, or do you find people enjoy the fact that it sounds really kind of go, especially when you're on the Event Horizon?
Yeah, and the initial intent was to step off the Event Horizon and hang around on the fleet to take a breather. That was the original intent. But then for those players, one of the things that it seems to be really hard to mitigate that happens in every game that we have to, where control has to step in, is one player being left to babysit a ship. Even if it's made super clear in briefing materials and in control briefing and in start a game briefing that no, you can lock your ship and leave it. Nobody's going to tamper with your ship unless you let them. But there's always one team that leaves one player to see it on their own. And no, I'm watching the ship. Okay, that's not going to be fun for anyone. But now... Some groups, like we did in, we ran the game in Nottingham. Maybe we have run it 7 times. Oh, right. When we ran it in Nottingham, they had a lunch break, and that seems to work well for this game. So it's hectic, quick lunch break of maybe half an hour, and then back into it. That gives people a bit of a breather, lets them talk about where the game is heading, what they think about that. Timing that lunch break, though, is crucial. But I think that sort of works, because otherwise, if you're one of those players who board the Event Horizon early on and then you get tangled up in a bunch of really exciting things, then you're not going to even have a chance to drink water for 4 hours, and that's not a good thing.
Absolutely. I think that's a classic thing I've noticed a lot of people in many games in general, just not eating or drinking, which is why I'm really definitely a fan of lunch breaks. So obviously the game has done really well. It seems like it's been really well received. I'm very curious about the horror elements and how those have kind of played out in practice, as you've seen it kind of as you've seen the game going on. Obviously, it is a game, it seems like, where lots of terrible things can happen to you. I see from the rules you can be knocked unconscious and things like that. How have you kind of incorporated those without, like, hopefully making people feel terrible in practice? And how's that worked out?
We use colored stickers as an abstraction for two types of injuries. You have a minor and major injuries. So control will, when something happens, they say, well, that's a minor injury. Tell me what happened or how what that injury is. And the player themselves will do the, you know, if they want to do the sort of body horror stuff, they're doing it to themselves. It's not control imposing that on anyone. Usually players don't have time to go into elaborate things. Usually it's, oh, I guess that's my arm gone then. And then the representation of injuries is on your player badge. So anyone can at any time can see that you're injured, and then they can ask you how bad is it? Well, my arm's missing. All right, let's get you patched up. So it really, really letting players set the tone of how much cosmic horror do you want to impose on yourself in this game? And that is really up to you. And I think that's a good way of both mitigating the sort of trigger warning stuff that you can have around, you know, it could be anything that, you know, I've seen all types of triggers in games where you really have to watch out and not ruin someone's day. So letting players themselves sort of be the messenger of their own story and the sort of narrative container for their own story, I think helps with that, and also lets them seek out other players to help them out once they're really injured.
Mm.
That's fantastic. That very kind of Nordic LARP style of
handling
it. It feels like.
And probably in a similar vein, I wanted to just ask about something you mentioned earlier about sort of subjective narrative building, where people need to make a lot of choices themselves as the players about what something means, and then that becomes part of the game's lore. That, I suppose, and also the injury principles, the horror elements, people deciding how much they want to be exposed. How does all that play out in action when you've got so many people in the game individually making those decisions? Like, have you encountered any players that have decided they're going to go against the subjective narrative that's been built, or any misunderstandings where people don't realize what's happening in other parts of the game, so they've missed a key narrative point? How is all that managed in the chaos?
Letting players be have so much to do that they're looking at the game through a straw. I think that's the sort of idea.
Yep.
So not knowing what is going on in the rest of the game is fine, because you have enough on your plate to deal with where you are right now. What's going on in the engine? I don't know. I'm at the other end of the ship and everything's on fire, so I don't really care what's going on in the engine. I hope it's something good, but right now I don't have the bandwidth for it. We need to put this fire out. And that sort of... I've found that players who have a certain way that they want to play this game gravitate toward each other during the game.
Right.
So we've not really had any problems with that. The problems we have had with this game and seem to continue to have is there's always one player, never more, but always one player who is a stickler for playing the game by the mechanical rules and not the narrative rules, which means it is a very social game, and people usually refuse to adhere to the make people awesome rule. Right. So we had one player who had real problems with the chain of command, and thinking that a chain of command is a strictly enforced mechanical rule, when in reality you can choose to obey the chain of command or you can choose not to obey the chain of command. And this player was not accepting that because he said, well, the chain of commands is in the rules, and not adhering to the chain of commands is not in the rules. So I'm locked out of doing things that I want to do because UN commander said, this is what we want you to do. So I now have to do that, and I don't want to do that. And in that sort of really clashes with my design philosophy, and it's really hard to get that type of player to because they're very stressed up and very agitated at that point, because it's gone so long and they had difficulties for 20 minutes trying to get through to this one person and trying to have them unlock opportunities for play, rather than going, well, if you don't want me to do that, then fine, I'm going to be over here doing that anyway. And try. Good luck trying to find me on board the Event Horizon, where you really can go off and live your life as you see fit without the chain of command, because nothing matters beyond that sort of... we touched on that, I think, before we started recording about the name of the game and whether that's copyrighted or not. But the event horizon is when you approach a black hole, there's a barrier or a point past which your actions don't matter outside that barrier. And I want the barrier between the two parts of the game, between the fleet and the event horizon, to be that barrier where chain of command doesn't matter, what you used to do in your past life or whatever, it doesn't matter. Your actions now are completely up to you. Your moral compass is your own, everything. And some players want that to be explicitly in the rules, but that takes away, at least for me, the curiosity and the exploration part of this, because it's not only an exploration of the Event Horizon, it's an exploration of playing games. It's an exploration of engaging with other players. It's an exploration of your own preconceptions of what a game is. This is very sort of, ambitious or maybe conceited, but you know, that's what I want it to be. Yeah. Just having fun with exploring whatever this is.
I think there's a lot of that kind of game and social philosophy that comes through in a lot of people's designs, even if they don't, you know, consciously think of it that way. I'm curious, the kind of player that you're describing there with the frustrations around narrative versus mechanical rules, I feel like there's an archetype for that in most games, in most mega games, where... Mm. You know, it's all about what people are expecting out of the game and what they hope it will be. Aside from those, I'm curious about what kind of feedback you have received personally, and then other people who've run it have received, particularly from those players who go into this who sort of have the classic sort of Watch the Skies structure as their benchmark for what mega games are like, and how that feedback has been received by you.
I think. You having run games, you know that there are basically two types of feedback that you get. You get the mechanical feedback where you can choose to read it and do something about it, or decide that, yeah, you probably maybe misunderstood what this mechanic is there for. So there's that. And there's the subjective sort of what happened in this game and what were my feelings about that. And that is interesting to read, and I always read that with more interest, but it's also really hard to make changes because like I said, this game has now run, let's say, 7 times, and it's been 7 very different runs, and right. Not because of things that we changed, but because of the players that played it. So those things that are very sort of experience-based and that type of feedback is very hard to do something about. But the thing that we are looking for is I didn't have a good day in this role. Yeah. And that's not based off of mechanics or how the game runs. It's just and a couple of things we had to change. So for that was the pacing of the fleet game. And there's a role that I'm trying to perfect that is I'm failing to do so. It's the role of that AM, and it's been scrapped now. There was a role of the psychiatrist that had sort of a detective, that had tabs on all the different narratives that were running, and for some reason that wasn't I don't understand why it wasn't a good role, but after like five runs we scrapped it because no person who played that role had a good day. And I think part of that has to do with the sort of make people awesome rule. Other players didn't really know what to make of this psychiatrist. They were a bit wary and maybe not including them. And the psychiatrists themselves were sort of nosy and trying to be everywhere, which was not appreciated by other players. So a bit of a snitch, maybe right. a snitch role. So we scrapped that. But I think like the main feedbacks we had early on was the fleet game is not engaging enough or not hectic enough, and we have changed that quite a bit, and it's arguably worse to be on the fleet now than on the Event Horizon, which is probably a good thing. And then just roles and trying to make the most of it. Very little feedback has been about I don't understand how the game runs or it doesn't let me do what I want to do. And a lot of it is more little tweaks and stuff like that at this point.
Right.
Apart from the people that you always get who write you an essay of how they would have designed the game if they had designed it. And you know, that goes in the bin straight away because, you know, it starts off from a very different perspective than what, you know, they have their preconception of what a game is. And, you know.
Yep. And I mean that diversity of feedback is always going to be there, like you say. So it sounds like it's all relatively positive in the sense that the feedback that is around experience and enjoyment of the game has skewed to the positive after all the runs and the little tweaks that you've made. So that is
I'll say this because we had a lot of success with Event Horizon in Sweden. We only run it twice, but it attracts new players, and that's been true now when we're running it in Edinburgh. There's been a lot of players who have signed up who haven't interacted with True North before. They're completely new to the group. So something about this game attracts new players. And what that's done for Gothenburg Mega Games is that brought a lot of people, maybe some 50, 60 odd players that are new to our group, but now use Event Horizon as the staple for what a mega game is, and they have that, then they have their feedback from the next game that they played will be comparing it to the first game they played, which was Event Horizon, which is not your standard mega game in any way, shape, or form, which makes expectation management for other games harder, I think.
Yeah, I feel like we are reaching that point though where the diversity of, dare I call them, mainstream mega games within this tiny niche hobby of ours. The diversity is becoming quite broad. And so I think that there's, in the next few years, I feel like there's going to be a lot of crowds who have a benchmark that is not what the, I don't know, pre-20s maybe crowd calls a mega game. So I think that's kind of exciting because it's going to obviously produce a whole bunch of sort of subgenres and new ideas and new approaches to design. I like the idea that Event Horizon has become sort of the benchmark there because it's definitely something very removed from what we've been running down here in our different groups. So I can imagine how it would have a different influence on the audience. We probably do need to wrap up, so I need to ask you the obligatory design questions. You've touched on a lot here, and I'm still sort of dwelling on people make people awesome. But what would you say is sort of your number one tip about the design process? What have you learned that you think is the most important thing that other people should keep in mind when they are looking at designing a mega game?
One, use a design process. A lot of people don't.
Yeah.
Since I do that for work, I use design thinking for everything I do, which is basically, I have this thing that I'm interested in. Let's subject a lot of people to it and test it and then figure out what to do with it. I find a lot of design work is done on your own, having no real feelers out there for what players are going to enjoy about this thing. So testing is very, very important. And just, you know, maybe not as extreme as I did with a sheet of paper and then just observing players do things. But all the design choices that I'm really proud of have been either trying to solve a situation that occurred during a playtest, or part of my design process is, if I know there are people that I know, friends of mine, that are going to be playing the game, I design certain elements of that game with them in mind. So a sort of end user in mind. I think that helps a lot. Second, never design a game on your own, but maybe don't go as big as design by committee, because that makes really shit games. But I think having a clear idea of what you want to do and then using other people to help you do that. My game would have been a LARP, not having played a single LARP in my life, but my game would have been a LARP if not Nicholas had said, you know, you probably need to strap some mechanics to this thing. It would have been a sort of very, very experimental art project LARP type of thing otherwise. Right. So I think that's, those are the main sort of design things I have. I base a lot of it off of watching people interact with the thing and then tweaking it based off of if I want more or less of what they're doing.
Yeah. And I think that involving extra people is becoming a really rich recurring theme in the conversations that we have, particularly with skill sets. So like you say, you've got a focus on observing and the player experience and trying to answer a question that you've got buried deep down ever since you first saw Event Horizon. And then you've got these people on your periphery being able to say, hey, maybe there's some dice to roll.
Yeah, exactly.
It's vital.
Or ask you, Nicholas is very good at asking good questions, which are not, how would you solve this mechanically? But just like, what are you trying to do?
Yes.
why is this thing here? Yeah. And as a designer, I think when you're on your own, you don't ask yourself that question enough. What is it I'm actually trying to do here? And just strip it down to the bare minimum of not mechanics, but what's the output that I'm looking for, and what's a good fun way of getting that output?
Yeah. Yep.
And also, I think your design process will probably be 75% less if you involve other people.
Definitely, yeah, definitely, yeah. It's almost exponential. Like you said, it's not great. Well, from my experience,
Don't wait until your design process is done to involve other people. Involve them very early on.
Yep, for sure. No, very valuable advice. Last question from me then, Johan. What in the mega game space are you working on next? Is there anything that you can tease listeners with?
Yes, we are running the 1.something version of Dino Island in Reading in April, end of April, I think, which is where Nicholas is the main designer and I'm doing the sort of what I do best on top of the mechanical things, because he had very cool mechanical ideas for a not Jurassic Park game, and I had some very interesting idea about corporate dysfunction that I wanted to explore, so I slapped that on top of that. So also things going wrong because of choices people make rather than mechanical or pre-formatted narrative ideas. So that's Dino Island. We're probably looking to package that up once we're done in Reading, I think. It's a very fun and solid game. Working on an updated version of Europa Universalis, because that became a bit too mechanical for my liking, even with the adjustments I made for the London run. We're running that for a convention in Gothenburg, probably by the time this comes out, so Easter. What am I? I'm working on a 1920s version of Event Horizon, which is going to be an interesting twist on the sort of setting it in the actual Lovecraftian timeline.
Wow.
And we do it, hopefully doing that for a 1920s game con that's running in Sweden, very sort of LARPy and roleplay, which would be really cool to do. And I'm working on a very sort of dogma type design with Rob Grayston, a warlords game, Chinese warlords game, which is based on. I think a slight tangent here, but I seem to be designing games about things that I'm interested in that are not sort of thematically interesting, maybe, but sort of interaction based. The Dino Island is corporate dysfunction. Europa Universalis is that there's this sort of I don't know, preconception in the mega game modern post 2020 mega game community that historical games are boring, historical games are not interesting, and historical games are hard to sell tickets to. So Europa Universalis is a way of sort of addressing that by putting a historical content with things that are batshit historically and just putting it in a sort of TV drama framework, and sort of reclaiming the historical space. That was the tangent. Now back to the Warlords game. it is a widely accepted truth that assassination mechanics are bad in mega games. Mm-hmm. So we based the whole game design around the assassination mechanic, just to play with it. And it seems to be, it's a very interesting way of doing the game. That's a subject for a different podcast, I think.
Yeah.
Well, sounds like a great hook.
All the conversations that I've had with Rob following, like since we did the episode with him about his survey, that makes complete sense that is what you're working on with him. So I'm very keen to follow that.
Very cool.
Awesome. And I believe, Johan, you're also planning to package up Event Horizon for sale, maybe by the time this podcast comes out, potentially.
It is out now. Let's just say this, it's out now.
You can go, we will definitely have a link and you will definitely be able to buy it.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Right, and I am,
it's those pesky last 2% of finishing the package.
I refuse to do any shame-based edits, so if it's not out, there will be an intro, there'll be a little cut here where I explained that it just didn't make it in time. So that's your deadline, Johan. We're helping you.
It will be out.
So what would you be, if someone does buy that package, what would you be your number one piece of advice for them if they're keen on running the game themselves in their own group?
That's a really tough question. I'll just say this. I'll promote the package first and maybe think about the answer to your question while I do that. But the package includes the game manual, a very comprehensive control manual, a bunch of inspirational things for if you want to feed in your own events or things, if things are not progressing. We've run it so many times that the control handbook is really comprehensive. And it includes a meeting with me where we discuss, you know, the ins and outs of the game and ask questions and things. So I've had that experience running other people's games. That's really valuable. You don't always understand the game design intentions and stuff. But I think that, but it is a really fun game to run. It seems to attract a lot of new players and has been well received. So I think just get it, run it, have fun with it. There's a lot of room to do your own thing with it. I think that's really important for mega games. So if you're somebody who loves running mega games, you should definitely get it. And if you love playing mega games, you should definitely play it.
That is good advice, straight from the designer and the seller. Jørn, thanks so much for chatting to us, and it sounds like you have quite a bit on your plate, so maybe we will chat to you again in the near future about dinosaurs or Chinese warlords.
Absolutely.